All right. Well, this panel is on greening anarchy. Of course, environmental politics are incredibly important, and I think it's something that came to anarchism way personally. These guys are going to talk about it, though. And I'm not going to give a big introduction. Instead, I'd like to just move into the panel so that we can make sure that all of the panelists have at least 15 minutes to speak. And afterwards, I'll do a comments, question, answer, and so on. Are all the title of his presentation is Militant Not Terrorist, How the Radical Animal and Liberation Challenges
I'll have to speak at that volume. If I get lower, maybe three of you guys in the back, just like wave something. People can hear me, I'm happy shouting.
We can't hear you.
You can't hear me, okay.
Nope.
Can you hear me now? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, so what I'm going to present is the product of, I think a lot of people, an academic paper that I wrote last year. I want to go through a little bit of the thesis and the methodology, not to bore people, but to show people that what I did is very approachable and what I did is relatively simple. So the thesis in short, which is what is summarized in the title, is that groups that are constituted as terrorists by mostly the United States, as well as the Canadian and British governments, in the case of the United States, called the number one domestic terrorist threat, epitomized in the Animal Liberation Front and the Earth Liberation Front. I'll go into the background of these groups in a second. That these groups, despite being called domestic terrorists, despite being called, you know, hyperbolically the number one domestic terrorist threat, are in fact groups that very, 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 very rarely utilize tactics that are even, by broad definitions, considered to be terrorism. So that's what I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to talk about why these groups are framed as terrorists and what function that serves from the state. So, what is the methodology? How did I do this? What I did is I looked at what I could find for all public source records of eco-terrorist violence. And again, like, I'm not going to apologize every time I use these terms. These terms are fucked up. Everyone knows eco-terrorism. Well, I hope everyone knows eco-terrorism. It's not a real term, but I'm going to use it because it's a broad term I'm going to use. Eco-terrorism is what the United States government began calling acts of property destruction, sabotage in the name of animals and environment. So what is the methodology? What I did is I looked at every available incident of eco-terrorism I could find. I found 27,000 incidents, ranging from 1972 with the foundation of the Band of Mercy in the United Kingdom up to the summer of last year. The sources range broadly. I look at the Animal Liberation Front, the Earth Liberation Front's own diaries, action reports they put out, thousands of communiques they put out. I cross-reference those with documents, similar documents by the FBI, by the Canadian CIS, whatever it is. Thank you. I look at British MI5 and a number of other, you know, public source documents. I don't work for the government, I don't access anything classified, so I'm reading the same thing anyone else can access. I look at these things, I put them into a thing called SPSS, which is basically a giant spreadsheet. For each incident of terrorism, I recorded 12 variables. The date it occurred, the group, if it was known, the general target, the general ideology, the tactic that was used, if there's casualties, if there's financial destruction, if it's part of a stated campaign, like the Shaft campaign or campaign against the Tar Sands project. I code any variable I can. I run these things through simple statistical analysis. I have high school math education. I have no post-high school math education. It's a really, really easy program. You can make a database on any number of things. You can hit graph, and it'll graph any number you can find. You can compare any set of variables, and it'll give you a finding. What I did is I used these 27,000 incidents of terrorism to determine whether or not Andy fit the definition. Okay. Why did I do this, and why I think this is important to the academic conference? One is that I think there's a serious need for a quantitative defense of these groups. We can through rhetoric and through a lot of things, say, yeah, that's not terrorists. They don't use terrorism. But when it push comes to shove, it's hard beyond our politics to kind of give a strong justification of that. Outside of that, at the academic level, there is no consensus definition of what is terrorism. That is a hotly contested topic ranging from whether a state can commit terrorism to whether an individual can commit terrorism to whether or not terrorism needs to include violence or threat of violence. So looking at definitions of terrorism is largely irrelevant because they're not even agreed on at the most, like, let's say, monolithic academic level. Let's say, like, the Harvard definition disagrees with the UN definition if you look at, like, two, you know, authoritative sources. So I think that one thing I want to do is be able to like back up with numbers and with data that the government provides itself, why I think what I think, and why I think hopefully a lot of people in this room would agree with the statement that these groups are not terrorists. And also, I want to provide a massive data set, and this is what I'd love to speak to people about after. I want to provide a massive data set that people can use in other ways. If someone in this room would like to argue that the Animal Rights Militia in the Netherlands between 1994 and 1997 didn't use terrorism because they want to look at the attacks, I can bring that data up in seconds. It's really a ridiculous program. It's very, very easy. So I want to provide this quantitative data so people can use it for other purposes. Okay, so that's what I did. What did I find? I found a number of things. I found one of the things is that the groups that are called terrorists in these eco-terrorism is a conflation of a huge amount of things. And I broke it down to basically five categories, which I hope we'll be relatively familiar with. Because of time constraints, like everyone else will say, I can't go into a huge background of what all these groups are. The first one we look at, which is considered under the eco-terrorist label, is public groups. Greenpeace, PETA, the climate camps in the UK. These are groups that are public, they have email addresses, they have membership lists, they do events publicly. They're not secret, they're not clandestine, they use illegal actions, they use direct action, they use sabotage, they use civil disobedience, but they're certainly not secret. They're public organizations. Greenpeace would be a prime example. The number two would be groups that are public that provide operational logistical support. These groups are also called terrorists. So we look at SHAC, Stop Hunting Animal Cruelty, which arguably you're not, produces information that's used by others to commit illegal actions. Again, they're a public group. They're public enough that they're in jail. We're in jail. You have people like Peter Young, who produce things called like the Blueprint, and it's a series of PDF documents which map out every single animal industry that he can find in the entire country. If you'd like a list of all the fur farms in the entire country, because you want to do whatever you want to do to them, there's a list of them. And he produces something called the Blueprint. It breaks it down by animal industry, it gives you targets and whatnot. And it provides a lot, I don't mean targets, that's not what I meant. But it's basically my targets of people to attack. That's the idea. Or things like the Animal Liberation Front Press Office, Earth Liberation Front Press Office. Public groups. Again, these groups are called terrorists, despite the fact they're public groups that commit no illegal actions. The third category that I found, which is conflated into this category, is what I call like the tolerated ones. So these are ones that, by all definitions, again, do tactics similar to the Animal Liberation Front. We look at the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, one by Paul Watson, which scuttles ships and, you know, in the past has laid landmines in ships. I mean, these are like key extreme examples of tactics. I mean, they do a lot of stuff with Future Facet and stuff. And they're tolerated. They have their own TV show on Animal Planet. If anyone would like to see a lark of a ridiculous TV show, I'd suggest you watch Whale Wars on Animal Planet, which glorifies the Sea Shepherds in a way that like it is so inconceivable for a group like Animal Liberation Front, despite the fact that tactics are very, very similar. So, tolerated. We have the Sea Shepherds. I also have Tim O'Berry, who was recently pictured in the movie The Cove. It's about dolphins. It's an okay movie, mostly a movie about dolphins. Tim O'Berry is known for, I think, like four or five separate occasions where he's facilities, including U.S. naval installations, and sabotaging and freeing dolphins. It's exactly what the Animal Liberation Front does, but he's not called a terrorist, he's not in jail, and as a biographical side note, he's the guy who trained Flipper, the dolphin, in Flipper the TV show. That's like his credentials. So he's called it. Also, it's a terrorist game. The fourth you have is clandestine groups, and this is like what the majority of the data comes from and what the majority of data is modeled on. Animal Liberation Front, Earth Liberation Front, and tons of groups that have similar names or issue anonymous communiques. Again, they're using arson, they're using sabotage, they're using a number of tactics in order to financially hurt industries that, let's say, adversely affect animals and the environment. And the last one is you have also clandestine groups that arguably, again, I say arguably, can constitute terrorists. They use what I classify in this research as anti-personnel tactics. Tactics that are designed to injure, kill, or at least scare. Okay, and these are the Justice Department, the Animal Rights Militia, and a couple other smaller groups that in the past have injured or killed people. Now, again, looking at 27,000 attacks, I can throw the statistics out, but 27,000 attacks, the rate of people even using tactics like this, including threat, which I would consider to be a relatively non-violent action, the number is like 0.01%. So you have 0.01% of attacks that constitute terrorism, even if the definition of terrorism includes things like threats. So fine, what's your average eco-terrorist attack? The average eco-terrorist attack by a broad majority is simple vandalism and property destruction. Gluing of locks, graffiti, breaking of windows, slashing of tires, sabotaging of machinery. Traditionally, none of these tactics have been considered terrorism. You can look at 1,000 different movements and 1,000 different things, and I'm not saying governments are happy with these techniques. I'm not saying that they endorse them, but they're not terrorism. Since 2002, the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the United States, has stated repeatedly for now going on 10 years every year that the Animal Liberation Front, the Earth Liberation Front, are the number one domestic terrorist threat to U.S. security. That's insane. I'm from Pennsylvania. We have a high concentration of white supremacists. Pennsylvania Pride, thank you. We have a high proportion of people who commit attacks motivated by neo-Nazi ideologies. I worked in an abortion clinic. We had an abortion clinic attack, was bombed. I mean, there's tons of movements we can point to that are domestic in the United States and other places which actually could constitute terrorism because they use threat and coercion to intimidate people, and they kill, and they try to kill. Okay, so fine. Why are these groups described as number one domestic terrorist threat if all the data doesn't support them? And this is kind of like what I would love to talk about for the majority of it, but I kind of need to give all that to do. And this is where like what I would call like an anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian, anarchist critique of the policy comes in. So what the governments or the states have been really good at is framing these threats as terrorism. One of the reasons they've done this is that these groups have been largely successful. In a lot of campaigns. I mean, they haven't abolished the eating of animals, they haven't abolished degradation of the environment, certainly. But the ALF in the United Kingdom decimated the fur industry. You don't have a lot of shops selling fur, you don't have a lot of shops making fur. This was like 20 years ago, and this is through breaking of windows and simple vandalism. The fur industry in the UK was decimated. The sea shepherds have seriously affected Japanese whaling. The Animal Liberation Front in other countries has destroyed a number of animal breeders and is now focused on Huntington Life Sciences. I can go into a ton of examples of what I would consider to be successes. These successes bring the wrath of the state. And this is, again, what I'm going to summarize in the last 4 minutes of this. Why has the state chosen to frame these groups as terrorists? Okay, they're effective. Also, I would argue that the tactics and the praxis and the ideology advocated by these groups actually challenges the state and capitalism. That it presents a legitimate challenge to state control in a number of ways. I'm going to go through these really at lightning speed. One is that these groups choose to meet the state where it operates in the mode of most people's lives, which is namely capitalism, which is namely the production and accumulation of money. We can meet these groups ideologically, we can meet these groups in a number of ways, but one of the most effective ways to mess with a corporation or mess with the state is to hit it in the pocketbook, because that's what a corporation exists for, and arguably that's why a state exists, to facilitate that interaction. So I'd say the state cares because they're actually hurting businesses, and businesses have gone bankrupt, including forcing the withdrawal of not bankrupting businesses, but forcing the withdrawal of multinational banks and lending institutions from providing insurance and other things to these corporations because they get targeted at a local level. You can also disrupt the social contract, the economic contract between states and their constituents. One of the main aspects of a modern neoliberalist capitalist state is to provide a venue that is pleasing to the accumulation of capital. You want to create a business, you want to create a country in an area where people can operate their business, whatever, or however horrific that business is. You want to create an atmosphere that can do that. This changes that because companies have to move countries or jurisdictions in order to not be attacked with slingshots and arson. The other thing is that it allows non-state actors like the Animal Liberation Front or small cells of people to actually negotiate at a state level. I don't see PETA talking to the USDA about farming practices, but I do see multinational developers having to cancel and reduce contracts because 10 people go out and burn their house down 10 times. That it provides a level of leverage, and this is like a larger argument about asymmetric warfare and things like that, but it allows small, weak, non-state actors to compete with large corporations and governments and force them to talk to them because they're hurting them. I got three more. There's a term called monopoly violence. It's an academic term, comes from Max Weber, or Weber, however you say his name, and I think it's interesting this. What he says is that states have monopoly on violence. States have police, states have armies, states have courts. These are violent institutions. As anarchists, we should all be okay with this idea. What I think that these groups do is they disrupt this. They say, you know what, army, like you can produce violence, you know what, police, you can produce violence, but like so can me and my three friends. Like we can also challenge what's called the monopoly of violence. There are other entities outside of state control which can do this. I think that challenges state control, it prevents a revolutionary praxis, which the state then has to contend with. It creates a spectacle. Spectacles are good for recruitment, spectacles are good for getting noticed. Again, if you want to look at arguments like that, look at some of the stuff around 9/11, about the spectacle of 9/11. There's been some really interesting articles about that. One is that the public support, and I think this is really key, so it goes back to the North American ALF Press Office and other groups, Spirit of Freedom in the UK, there's a bunch of them, definitely forgetting, that public support and public unabashed support for illegal and what are called uncontrollable groups, these groups that can't negotiate, I think that act itself is an important act to say, as myself, as I just published under a really conservative university, that I support the Animal Liberation Front. I think they do good, legitimate work. I think their tactics are legitimate. I think that the methodology they use are well-reasoned and come from a long history of other similar actions dating back to, you know, silly example with the Boston Tea Party. I think that to publicly support these groups is again, A, it challenges them not blaming violence, and B, it challenges state control in a certain sense. I'm not saying it's in itself a state-crushing revolutionary act, but to elicit support for these groups, I think, is very, very key and very, very powerful. And the last thing, and then this is really key in the Shack campaign, if people aren't familiar with this campaign, a number of groups trying to shut down Huntington Life Sciences, animal breeding lab, they should really look into it, because it really is, I think it is a very instructive model for 1,000 campaigns. But one is that we're forcing the state's hand in a number of ways. So for instance, through the Shack campaign, they have forced the governments of the UK to bail out this company, because no one will insure them, because when, let's say, Bank X insures this company, someone goes to the CEO of Bank X's home that night and destroys his car, and Bank X says, well, I can insure someone else, why would I insure this company that's going to get my car destroyed? So one of the things that these campaigns have done is they've forced the state to show their hand. They've kind of forced the invisible hand of capitalism to be shown. And you see that, as again, I hope we could all agree as anarchists, that capitalism is not a free market in any sense. But it shows the method and the ends to which the states will go to prop up their main interest, which in my mind would be the continuation of capitalism. For those reasons, I think these groups are being targeted. For those reasons, I think these groups are important and are supported. I know that was really fast. This is like 4 months of research and 300 pages. If people have specific questions on this, I'm more than happy to talk about how to use this research. And if you ask me afterwards, I can send you a copy of it. It's a copy of it. Okay? Thank you.
Usman Mushtaq, they're going to talk about responses to climate change, radical critiques, and utopian alternatives.
Is there anything we can do about it?
Yes, there's a light switch over there on
Build up of what?
Like, can we shift a little bit? There's some room over here for people.
If anybody has any inches, can we all move to the right, maybe?
Yeah, folks can fit.
That everyone here accepts that anthropogenic or human-caused climate change is real, or at least minimally, that the human relationship to the wider non-human world is unsustainable and causes untold harm both to human and to non-human living communities, not to mention irrevocably altering the non-human, non-living environment in ways that will cause consequences that we cannot possibly predict or control. We're also proceeding from the premise that responses to climate change that presuppose the continuation of the nation-state, capitalism, patriarchy, forms of neocolonialism are equally flawed and bound to fail. That is, we're suggesting following the traditional knowledges of many indigenous and other land-based peoples, as well as the work of anti-authoritarians like Murray Bookchin and others, that the character of human communities largely prefigures the respective relationships to the wider non-human world. We also both agree that responding to the climate crisis requires some context and culturally specific critiques and reconstructive strategies. By this we mean that blanket criticisms or totalizing strategies that don't take into account the particulars of bioregion, class or economic status, gender and sexuality, cultural traditions and knowledges, forms of ableism and so forth. Obviously this is not a complete list, but hopefully you get the idea. The strategies that don't take these things into account are problematic and will not facilitate the sort of work that needs to happen. So, when we argue for the context and culturally specific forms of critique and strategies, a big part of this is showing a commitment to solidarity with marginalized peoples, recognizing that we each occupy different positionalities, and that showing solidarity with, for example, indigenous nations who are struggling for self-determination and control over traditional lands, or alternatively, poor people in North American urban centers who are struggling with day-to-day realities of trying to maintain a decent quality of life. This means that we have to be nuanced in our critique and our reconstructive approaches. For example, our commitments to sustainable, non-hierarchical world might compel us to urge a general call for people to grow their own food, or to shop at a local farmer's market, or participate in a community-supported agriculture program. But this doesn't take into account any number of understandable factors that would cause a person to place commitments to ecological practices lower on their list of priorities. Other examples might deal with the use of technologies, which Guzman is going to speak about. What this means for me is that we have to be very careful with our rhetoric and our projects, such that we walk the fine line between making the needed criticism of the mainstream discourses that take for granted the continuation of capitalism and the nation state and so forth in response to climate change, while taking care to simultaneously agitate and advocate in solidarity with marginalized peoples, given the realities of the world that we live in. Further to this, I want to argue that our best strategies for responding to climate change are less of the learning survival skills and preparing for working to bring on the inevitable collapse of civilization, and more of working to establish prefigurative, cooperative, ecologically oriented projects and networks that seek to reach across traditional borders of race, class, ability, and so forth. Again, that's an incomplete list. The idea is that we're trying to establish working alternatives to the dominant order. Generally speaking, I believe our time and energy is much better spent carving out spaces and creating projects that help to make life better for humans right now and make the relationship between humans and the non-human wider world better right now. And in doing so, help to model or experiment us toward an ever more widespread establishment of sustainable human communities. The prevalence of doomsday or collapse-oriented thinking and action strikes me as neglecting to consider the realities that many humans face, and the likelihood that the sort of doomsday collapse would do untold harm on the non-human world as well. I do want to emphasize, following the work of Richard Day and others, that we ought to avoid hegemonizing our approaches. That is, adopting a totalizing approach that seeks to universalize one critical framework or political strategy, and recognize that just as a nuanced analysis recognizes cultural and contextual specificity, our strategies and tactics are necessarily going to take different forms at different times and places. It is our shared political and ethical commitments to bringing about a better world that have to be at the heart of our thinking, debate, and action. So while I have criticisms of the anti-civ perspective, for example, I certainly don't want to be misunderstood as not recognizing the very important and unfortunately still very unpopular shared rejections of capitalism, the nation state, colonialism, and so forth, which is the perspective that I'm articulating and the anti-civ perspective. An important question, I think, is how we deal with the inevitable disagreements that take place between those of us committed to building more non-hierarchical and ecological world and responding to the threat of climate change. I think the questions of culture and context are again vital as is remaining dedicated to the principles of solidarity and non-hegemony. If as much time and energy was spent prioritizing solidarity and cooperation that has been spent in trying to demolish those arguments and actions with which we may have some degree of disagreement, I'm convinced that our movements and the positive impacts that they make will continue to grow exponentially. So while it's true that the harmful effects of climate change are already being felt, not the least by indigenous and other land-based peoples, I don't think any of us can, nor should we, predict the inevitability of a nightmarish future. If we can maintain our commitments to culturally and contextually specific critique and action, will have a real cause to be optimistic, even utopian, about our aspirations for the future.
That was great, Carl. So before I begin, I want to go back to this image and just show the image. I just pulled this off in Google Images. It's from some diner in the U.S. And I think it encapsulates critics of global warming really well. Like, you have your drive through open 24 hours, and it's brought to you by Visa and MasterCard. Can everyone hear me? Okay.
Back.
So while Carl concentrated on the political side of our assertion that responding to climate change requires contextual and culturally specific critiques and reconstructive strategies, I'll be talking more about technology and what role technology might play in these strategies as we respond to climate change. So, some anarchists and, let's take, for example, anarcho-primitivists have responded to climate change by, as Carl said, preparing for the inevitable collapse by learning survival skills. So these are people who, will go out in the woods and learn how to hunt and live out in the woods off the grid. Great. So as part of this learning survival skills, many have wholly rejected technology, as they see no use for technology, in the coming collapse. They point to wind farms to show that even such a clean, renewable technology, such as wind turbines, cannot appropriately respond to climate change. But I, as Carl, would argue that this is actually a very naive North American settler response to climate change. We can't all go out in the woods and learn how to hunt. I've tried to do that with two other South Asian men, Muslim men, and we've been tracked down by a park ranger. And actually fined for illegal camping. So I can only imagine what his response would have been if we had hunting equipment. So clearly, not all of us can respond to climate change in that way. By the way, the best part of the story is that the ranger's name was Floyd Hawk.
Wow.
So that's a great ranger name. I'm arguing that we can't all learn to hunt in the woods because we're placing ecological concerns over other priorities. But we're also, I would argue, conceptualizing technology strictly in terms of post-Enlightenment European science, i.e. progress is always good, technology always moves forward. But what I will argue is that there's very different models of technology and different models of science, and we can learn from them. Uri Gordon is a famous anarchist, and he has written some thoughts on technology in his essay, Anarchism and the Politics of Technology. He says, technology both expresses and reproduces specific patterns of social organization and cultural interaction, drawing attention to the momentum of large-scale socio-technical systems, to the response of modern societies to certain technological imperatives, and to the way human ends are powerfully transformed as they're adapted to technical means. Basically what Uri is saying is that technology has certain values in it, and our response to that should be to look at what values are what values are embedded in such technology. So let's take a big wind farm, for example. I'm from Kingston. There's a huge wind farm located right offshore Kingston on Wolf Island. I don't like wind farms because, as Colin Ruggiero says in his essay, Radical Green Populism, the regime that wind farms stands to replicate is characterized by extremely large, complex, centralized, and hierarchically managed systems reliant on and constantly reinforcing a social contract that's predicated upon a highly balanced lot, right? So you get the idea. So what should we do about it? We can't, you know, certain communities can't live without it. If we're thinking about how, you know, communities in the global south are responding to it, how, you know, how should they develop technology? So again, Uri Gordon takes a shot at answering this question. He says, I would suggest that such a politics would encourage manifold low-tech innovations in areas like energy, building, food production, traditional plant knowledge, artisanship, craft, the recycling and recombination of decaying technological systems may give rise to an open-source hardware movement, which could have its seeds in the direct action ethic of do-it-yourself and self-organization. Great. So the, you know, that's a good start. But again, that's about how we reuse technology. What about making new technology? He doesn't really answer that in his essay. What I'd like to do now is point to two examples. Well, I don't even matter at this point. So my assertion is that you know, anarchist conceptions of technology, you know, are still based in this post-Enlightenment European science model, and so there are certain values or ideas in that, such as progress is always forward, technology always leads to greater complexity, technology is generic, technology is artificial. But that's actually, thank you, that's actually, you know, technology doesn't have to be conceived of in those terms. So I'll give you two examples. One is that medieval Arab scientists valued water as an energy source for many of their inventions, given their, you know, particular historical geography, which is, you know, a very arid desert region. Water was an important part of their culture, and so water was used as an energy source above other energy sources, like burning biofuels, wood, coal, etc. So here, we're here in this particular historical instance, we can see a different path of technological development in which water is used as an energy source as opposed to coal or burning wood, which is sort of the energy development that happened in European science. Another interesting conception of technology has been put forward by the Native Science Academy, which is based in the US. It's a research network in the U.S. of various indigenous activists, academics, and educators. They put out a paper titled, "Is it possible to have information technology that reflects indigenous consciousness?" In the paper, they outline some characteristics of indigenous technology, such as indigenous technologies are recognized as alive, living things. They value and respect the natural world. They recognize the realms of the invisible. They symbolize the collective nature of indigenous cultures. An indigenous technology attracts the learning spirits and provides the learning ecology that supports the transformation and revitalization of awareness and knowledge, and, you know, and so on and so forth. But here you can see a very different conception of technology, one that's rooted in realms of the invisible, in nature. And so what I'd like to put forward is that, you know, we can take, you know, we can use these conceptions of technology to create technology to respond to climate change in a responsible manner. You know, one that doesn't leave out communities, different communities, but includes them. Okay, so I'm told I should finish up, so I will. So the last slide, I just want to end with, but wait, there's hope. So, you know, We're not all the coming collapse, you know. This is actually like a great moment. You know, we're dealing with climate change. You know, all may be lost, but actually it's a great moment for cross-cultural, cross-contextual cooperation because danger cuts across all communities. It's a great moment for a boom in appropriate technologies. It changes in the way we plan our communities, the way we meet our water needs, our sanitation needs, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, and then one more thing. There was a really great panel, actually, in this room right before us. And one of the panelists, Liat Ben-Moshi, was talking about how anarchists need to switch from a ethics of DIY, like do-it-yourself, to an ethics of DIT, do it together. And so... I actually wrote it down because I thought it fits great into our presentation. because you know that's what Carl and I are talking about these cooperative, prefigurative, ecological communities of cooperation where the ethics isn't one of doing it yourself, but one of doing it together.
Our next speaker is Andrea Palachuk. I'm not mangling your name. Excellent. She's going to talk about alienation and exclusion in food lifestyle politics and anarchist organizing.
Okay, so please forgive me. This is like pretty much everything I've been working on for a while. This is 6 pages. So there's a lot of leaps and jumps, and just bear with me. And hopefully we'll get through this. I'm going to read because I get nervous otherwise. So my work argues that food lifestyle movements, which emerge as a kind of resistance to the increased industrialization of food and agriculture, continue to work according to neoliberal governmentality, which I'll explain, in the sense that these movements involve neoliberal subjects, in scare quotes, performing and simultaneously consuming identity and continue to produce subject-other relations of power that are structured through neoliberal governmentality. And just a side note, what initially interested me in the study of food was my involvement with known as illegal and migrant justice issues, just to give you an idea of where I'm coming from in this study. I was interested in how food was naturalized as a commodity to be profited from, which requires the creation of racialized, class, gendered, and indentured non-citizen labor to be exploited. I've extensively argued elsewhere that the commodification of food inherently requires and therefore produces, both structurally and through power knowledge or ideology, conditions of exploitation. And what I'm in the really preliminary process of examining are some of the counter-movements that have arisen as a result of the increased industrialization of agricultural practices, which increasingly exploit environmental systems and human and animal bodies. Some of these movements include the Go Local and or Organic movements, which advocate adopting a diet based primarily on locally and independently sourced and sometimes organic food products, or adopting a solely organic diet. The assumptions of these lifestyle changes are that locally sourced food requires less fossil fuels for transportation and yada yada, and maybe more ethical labor practices. I won't go into it because I'm sure I'm in a room full of people that know this shit. My research attempts to critically question these movements, not only by challenging some of their assumptions, but by also calling attention to how they do not challenge the relationship of exploitation that is inherently encompassed in the commodification of food, especially because they continue to commodify it. Furthermore, with an emphasis on Foucault's theory of governmentality and subjectification, and also with queer theorists' critiques of identity as performed through consumption, while arising from and reproducing neoliberal governmentality, my research attempts to call attention to these movements as performances of identity, which I'll try and explain. So just to briefly get into some of the jargon that I just drew out, governmentality can be explained, as Mitchell Dean has argued, it's a political rationality that entails any attempt to shape with some degree of deliberation aspects of our behavior according to particular sets of norms for a variety of ends. So it's hierarchy structuring our very identities and behaviors. I think anarchists are sympathetic to this idea. While neoliberal discourse has naturalized the neoliberal market structure, neoliberal governmentality as a relationship of power knowledge has particular sets of norms embedded into it. These norms are established in simultaneously naturalizing the white male bourgeois individual, a neoliberal entrepreneurial subject who is self-managing, self-improving, and productive in the neoliberal economy, while also constructing racialized non-citizen other bodies as more exploitable. Hence, neoliberal governmentality operates not only as a logic that valorizes and prioritizes market relations and the maximization of profit, it is also a form of governance through power knowledge relations, institutional assemblages, and discourse that works to produce self-disciplining subjects and others embedded in relationships of exploitation. Subjectification is interconnected with governmentality in that governmentality produces political subjects, but also implies an internalized sense of power, such that the subject becomes self-producing and self-disciplining according to particular neoliberal rationalities. Lisa Duggan and other queer theorists have linked identity to the process of neoliberal subjectification. That is, where identities were once considered transgressive and gaining visibility and recognition for marginalized others and serving as a form of resistance to normalized subjectivity, they've been appropriated by processes of capitalism. We can speak of gentrified identities, power knowledge opportunities of disruption to hegemonic systems of domination that have become instead a kind of lifestyle that is bought into. Just as queer communities have become gentrified and gay and lesbian identities have become appropriated, packaged, and sold back to queer identified subjects to consume, and just as punk cultural symbols have been appropriated, mass-produced, and sold back to those desiring to be a part of the counterculture, so have organic and local food been aestheticized, branded, and sold back to hybrid-driving yuppies everywhere. Alternative food is a lifestyle that is bought into. Individuals gain a sense of validation and moral worth based upon their consumption behavior. It becomes part of one's personal brand. Indeed, sometimes a shift of organic to organic food is based on concerns for health, which can easily be read through Foucault's ideas of biopolitics and a neoliberal economy. It's the individual's responsibility to care for his or her own body in order to remain productive in the economy and therefore contribute to capitalist society. Sometimes participation in food lifestyle movements arises out of being disciplined by greenwashing discourses. That's neoliberal appropriations of environmentalism have placed the onus of ecological health on the individual and his or her ethical consumer choices. So it's about our job as consumers to end environmental crises instead of like a collective movement. And so we can see a kind of neoliberal subjectivity at work here. The good neoliberal subject is responsible for consumption and to consume responsibly. Food lifestyle movements grounded in liberal ethics have adopted a kind of disciplining morality. Good, eco-friendly, small business shopping subjects morally discipline each other, such that ethical consumption becomes a kind of social duty and exclusive bourgeois club. I should note also that there's kind of a bourgeois ambivalence to food lifestyle movements, such that instead of being motivated by health or eco-responsibility, individuals become a part of these movements simply out of a sense of pleasure. They're attracted to the locally sourced food because of the exquisite quality of the ingredients. They represent a certain eliteness in a dominant consumer culture that's been highly preoccupied with aestheticized food and all that's gourmet. Hence, in part, this type of farming thrives because it produces those patterns of inclusion and exclusion. And they're attractive precisely because they're exclusive. So we can see how identity kind of plays into it here. Food lifestyle movements are not effective political resistances because they do not dismantle and disrupt the current relations of power and domination. They continue to commodify food, which inherently requires exploitation in order to obtain profit. Apart from generating patterns of exclusion through identity and operations of power knowledge, there are also structural elements at work. High costs, extra shopping time associated with these types of foods, and there's also a race, class, and gender barrier in terms of who can participate in these movements because of those kind of more structural elements and geographical accessibility. And there's also even a cultural and colonial aspect to the accessibility of these movements, in that they problematically reproduce aspects of what Nandita Sharma has called white nationalist ideology. So we can think about Eurocentric recipes and 100-mile diet cookbooks, or Eurocentrically aestheticized food products in farmers markets, or also the idea of supporting local businesses, which reproduces white nationalist ideology, because it creates this local elsewhere distinction that valorizes usually white middle class citizen farmers. It is a resistance to corporately owned, highly industrialized, exploitative agriculture. I'm not going to say that it's not. But when local farms are owned by hardworking white landowning individuals, and corporate farms are located in foreign, read, non-white states, or are local but rely on racialized non-citizen labor, where there's a problematic element of power knowledge at play here, where the neoliberal subject is idealized and valorized, and racialized bodies are othered and considered dangerous or dirty. And I'm running out of time, so also the fact that local farm and organic farmers require often the use of equally exploitable labor because they usually rely on things like woofer programs. Does everyone know what that is? Okay. So it's still unpaid labor. It's just voluntary unpaid labor and not racialized indentured labor. So it's not necessarily the most sustainable model of food production. And I was hoping to raise some of these questions to anarchist organizing, but I'm running out of time. Basically, I'm just hoping that as anarchists, we might ask ourselves how, if we're dogmatically wedded to any ideas of identity, and if we produce our own cultural aesthetics that are alienating to other people, and maybe we can talk about that a bit more in the discussion. Woo!
Michelle's going to be talking about, she's framing her presentation as a question, I'm sorry. The question is, are community gardens inherently radical?
Okay, so today I'm going to talk about my master's research that I did at the University of Lisbon, and it talks about anarchist theory and the Conagram community garden. And my research posed this question: can community gardens help to radically shape the food system? You guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I start to whisper when I get nervous. Okay, so problem. Athens, Georgia is about an hour to the east of Atlanta. It's a college town, population about 120,000 people. And about 36,000 of those people are individuals classified as living in poverty. This is a huge disparity between the predominantly white transient student population and the predominantly black part of it, like northern part of the city. And in the past 10 years or so, the issue of food security has really developed into sort of like this hot topic. Lots of organizations have popped up, Green Up Bombs, Place, which is promoting local agriculture and cultural experience, the Athens Food Policy Council, and the Athens Urban Food Collective. So, for my master's research, I was interested in helping to coordinate a community garden. So I went to Common Ground, which is a local progressive resource center and networking site that started in 2003 as a sort of a place that people could meet and try to organize some sort of action against the George W. Bush administration. And it kind of developed into this pretty large space that has 28 affiliate groups, which are different nonprofits in Athens that pay money to the space to help keep it running. And there's like a coffee machine and a kitchen and lots of communal space for meetings. So when I approached them with the idea, they were really excited because they had this big backyard that they weren't using. So we organized 12 to 15 people, and the growing season ran from May 1st, 2008 to September 2008. So as an academic, I was really interested in theory, and I noticed as I was reading, particularly the past 5 years of literature on community gardens, that they all sort of had, they shared this sort of anarchist notion of these five things, freedom and anti-authoritarianism, critique of the capitalist food system, empowerment and autonomy, community and mutualism, and praxis. And whether those gardens were, sort of guerrilla-style urban gardens or even prison gardens or school gardens, they all sort of frame community gardens within these sort of five ideas. So after reading all that literature, I was thinking that, you know, okay, community gardens, they seem like they're inherently radical, but during the course of my project, I ran into a number of issues that kind of called that radicalness into question.
Praxis is what?
It's like theoretically informed action. So you come up with an idea, you put it into practice, then you use the results of that to come back and re-inform your theory. So it's this sort of like cycle. I don't know if that makes sense. So who's hungry? Okay, so I ran into my first problem that I ran into is my original plan was to organize a group of women from the housing project across the streets, one of the most urban areas in Athens, and basically use the space as a place for women to grow food. But when I approached Common Ground with that idea, they weren't really receptive because they saw themselves as a community space and so wanted to be inclusive of anyone who wanted to participate. So when I agreed to that, what ended up happening is that the participants were pretty much came from Common Ground already, so they were predominantly young, white, college-educated activists, which made for a very different garden. So unfortunately, throughout the, you know, we agreed that, you know, because it was like an activist space, that we decided, okay, we should grow the food communally, and we should share it in like community-style dinners. So that way we could like offer food to the community and anyone could come and eat. But because of a number of problems that we ran into, we didn't actually produce very much food, so we pretty much just fed ourselves. So in the end, when I was doing my interviews, and you know, I was asking people, like, what do you think about the fact that we didn't feed any hungry people, and that was sort of the original intention of the garden, people talked about their experiences more in terms of, you know, they had fun playing in the dirt, and they got to learn how to, you know, care about plants and that sort of thing, and it didn't really seem like that big of a deal that we didn't feed any hungry people. A second problem that we ran into is, it wasn't really necessarily directly in the garden itself, but associated more broadly with the Common Ground space, which is what I call the liberal radical divide in progressive politics. So, for example, Green Up Bombs is one of the affiliates at Common Ground, and like I said, there's a number of affiliates that pay dues to like keep the space going, but Green Up Bombs obviously doesn't operate in that same manner. And there's a number of people at Common Ground who really did not like the fact that Green Up Bombs mooched off of everybody else. And so, for example, one guy walked into Common Ground one day and there were two big trash bags full of rotting squash that had been left as a donation for Green Up Bombs because they used the kitchen to cook. And no one had been in there in several days and they had leaked all over the kitchen and the living room. So as we were cleaning it up, he basically used that hour to bitch about Food Not Bombs. And he's like, you know, because it's non-hierarchical, there's no one for me to point my finger at, you know, to blame for this problem. And, you know, people, they don't have, you know, they're not paying dues, so, you know, they're just causing a bunch of problems for everyone else to deal with and not contributing to the space. Another example, one of the guys who's one of the main people at Common Ground had a very lengthy background in nonprofit management. I ran into him one day outside of Common Ground, and we talked for about an hour about the future of this sort of space, and he said for him that Common Ground should just be streamlined, cut out all the direct action sort of stuff, and just, you know, basically could operate on the top floor of an office building. And so, like a community garden, obviously wouldn't be associated with it either. And you know, he had this big flow chart drawn up so you could kind of see like who did what under who and that sort of thing. So at the same time, there was also elections going on for a new board of directors. And two of the people who were associated with the garden and with Common Ground as volunteers were running for office. And they were running on this platform of like, okay, we need more community involvement, more of this sort of action. And so when I told them what the other guy said, they were just like, what? Like, that's not how it started. So, you know, it turned out to be this like huge sorts of tension between, you know, different sides of, you know, different people within Common Ground that actually led to the demise of Common Ground in 2009. So, and I mean, part of it was funding, but I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that they just couldn't figure out how they wanted to do it. The third problem that I ran into is the decline in participation. So I don't know if any of you guys have ever been to the Atlanta area in the summer. But it is, you know, over 100 degrees, 99% humidity. It's absolutely awful. I hated working in the garden, and so did everybody else. There's like mosquitoes everywhere. We were in like one of the worst droughts in 100 years in that area. I mean, it was just absolutely, it was just like everything was against me. So yeah, you can imagine. Plus it's a student community. So over the summer, people are leaving, going out of town, and that sort of thing. At the same time, participation in the community dinners that we had, you know, didn't decline because that was definitely the fun part. So essentially, people were just started working less and eating the same amount. So that kind of, you know, was a problem too. But at the last community dinner, someone brought up the idea of having a fall garden, and I was all about it because, you know, people are back from school, you know, back for class, and the weather is way better. And so we scheduled a date and a time, and I was the only one that showed up. So, yeah, so that was the end. Kind of a fitting ending, actually, to the Common Ground Garden. So some considerations. Okay, at least in terms of the Common Ground Community Garden, it was definitely radical in theory because it sort of meshed with those sort of five anarchist ideas, but not technically in practice. And I think the most important factor for a lack of success in the garden was the fact that there were no hungry people involved at all, even not even just consuming the food, but even constructing like the garden and the project itself. So I think that if we had like really made a push to include hungry people, then I think it would have turned into a very different garden. Not necessarily successful, but just very different. So I think we should be wary maybe of garden projects that seem to paint this sort of rosy picture of possibilities without addressing some key questions, particularly the third one, who benefits from the project and in what way? And the fourth one, how can we evaluate and improve the project to ensure positive radical change? So really this idea of just sort of like critical self-reflection along the way. And I really wish that I had gotten to, you know, take this into, I'm talking really fast, obviously. So I really wish that we had gotten a chance to take this into the next growing season. But, you know, that was the end. We got one shot at it, and it kind of failed. So in the end, I think community gardens, such as the one at Common Ground, really do still provide an important way to address issues of hunger and food quality, regardless of all the problems that we ran into. And I think really our challenge is just to consistently and purposely seek to match practice with theory. So community gardens and other sort of radical food movements are, I think, laying the groundwork for a shift to a radically different food system, and it's through those sorts of small-scale alternative projects that we can test out alternatives and see what works and what doesn't and why. Okay.
Could someone turn the lights back on? About 20 minutes for discussion, so I'm going to take three comments at a time, and I would ask you to please keep it pithy and short so that we can accommodate as many people as possible. I've got one, two, and three. Okay? So over here.
So it was interesting to have the comment that believing that progress and continuous improvement results from technology is a part of Western or scientific technology. But if that's intended to mean that the more appropriate response is to think that maybe technology doesn't always work out for the better, then I don't think that's going far enough. Because it seems to me that if you're advocating that we go for non-Western forms of technology, then you're still believing that there is a form of technology that does work out for the better. And I think we have to question that. And I don't think that's at all the same thing as the primitivist argument. I mean, they have their own particular reasons for believing what they believe, and I don't think we have time to discuss that. But I'm not arguing that we have to throw everything away. I'm arguing that we have to stop progressing, that knowledge itself is problematic, and we have to recognize that. And therefore, simply looking for another value system in technology is not going to save us from the danger of continuing progress. We have to become anti-progressive.
Who was it over here? Yeah.
I have a question for Andrea, but With your criticism of lifestyle-based food choices, doesn't the criticism you're leveling and the sense of your current role go the same for vegetarianism as veganism? Like, I'm a vegan, but does it really promote the revolution if I eat mayonnaise rather than mayonnaise? Or how can we take these practices and make them different than the bourgeoisie consumption of organic produce?
Okay, there's a third over here, and then I'll do around them on the, for the panelists, okay? Yeah.
This is a question for, I'm sorry, you're working. Michelle. I was just wondering in your project, if you, when you came up with these problems in on that you were working with the whole time, where people had different points of view and you couldn't get aligned and there wasn't a way that anyone was focusing on anything specific, did you use different forms of communication skills? Were you, did you use any conflict resolution or mediation? Or where? How did that draw in? Because I think that as we're working, those problems are always going to come up. And I think having really good communication skills and getting people to commit to seeing how they use words and what action they're directing is really the root of a lot of problems in a way. So I was just wondering if you did that. And the other thing would be, like, when you were doing your project, what different things did you try to do to engage the community that never came that was hungry? Because there is that is really hard, and I'm getting involved in a project like that, similar to yours. So I'm just curious what you did.
All right, what I'd like to do is just kind of go down the line. We know Michael can, like, speed talk, too, so that might help us move along. But I would ask that the speakers also keep it pithy and short. Carl?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that we should question progress and question technology. But for me, the more important question is, how do we create, the last line in my notes is, how do we create political and social spaces where we can begin to think about different models of technology? These political and social spaces would be the prefigurative, cooperative, ecologically oriented projects and networks, which we're always talking about. And actually, like, when you first mentioned it to me, I was like, oh, that's actually, like, a nice set of words, you know, there. But, anyway, yeah.
Okay, so your first question was about conflict resolution, right?
Yeah, communication.
Yeah, well, actually, I have to admit that my thesis is a little less critical of the actions in the garden than I think I am now that I've had time to reflect on it, because within the garden itself, I mean, no one disagreed. I mean, really, I mean, like, kind of the conclusion of my thesis is, like, food is kind of uniting all these people. I mean, there are people who are, like, pretty far right to pretty far left working in the garden, and they all just had an interest in growing food for whatever reason. I mean, there were two people who I guess would identify as libertarian, so maybe they're not doing it to critique the capitalist food system or whatever, but, I mean, they're all about the idea of, you know, I need to know how to do this for myself and that sort of thing. So, I mean, really, within the garden itself, I didn't have to worry about it. And then within Common Ground, kind of broader in Common Ground, I was kind of an observer of it. I mean, they tried meetings, where, people would vote by consensus of how's it going to go next, and it just fell apart. So I wish that there was, like, something that, we could have done about it. But for the most part, I was just watching, people just argue. I mean, kind of in irreconcilable differences. And then your second question was, involving the community, right? Well, at first, I mean, to be honest, our garden is really, really small. We had hoped that it would produce a lot more, but because of the drought, plus a number of other things, the soil wasn't very good, and I mean, we admitted as much as we could, but it just really didn't produce any food. So when it came time for the first community dinner, we were going to try to, reach out to people. We were like, well, right now this is all we have, so we'll just start with us, and we can bring people, you could bring a couple people with you, and it just never got off the ground. So it was kind of a garden club, honestly, instead of some sort of, like, awesome radical project. So Yeah, I think that if I would have done it differently, I would have organized very differently instead of just doing kind of word of mouth, people involved with Common Ground. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your
question. Yeah, that's cool. I mean, that's what happens when you just keep going and going.
Okay, I think I'll be quick. I agree with you, like, with the veganism thing. Like, I think eating processed food is equally as problematic. But for me, what I'm interested in is, like, I think there's a tension between individual choices and collective radical struggles, right? So if our politics is based in our individual decisions of what we're going to eat and what we're going to do, like, that's great. But how does that dismantle the current system? And how it still produces, it's easy for the state to buy into that, right? Because we're performing our individual responsibility to be more ecologically friendly. And so it fits in with the neoliberal logic and doesn't necessarily dismantle it. So I agree with you that eating veganese is not necessarily vegan, but I don't want to police other people's decisions, and I also don't want that to be the basis of my politics.
Okay, three pithy short comments. One, two, and three. Yeah.
Yeah, around gardening, you mentioned about that people weren't hungry. So I think that was key. If you've got people that are hungry, they're going to have a certain kind of incentive to grow food. I think this was back in the 70s, Francis Lappe ruled Diet of a Small Planet said that 90% of the grain produce of America was used to feed animals. That might be changed now with the introduction of biofuel. But if anything, North America, through technology, has an overproduction of grain. Unfortunately, it's GMO, grown with toxic chemicals or herbicides, poisoning the earth, and industrial. But, you know, the thing is that it's simpler for people to go out and buy whatever it is that they're going to buy. So until some of those corporate-controlled approaches are addressed, and at the same time people try to be independent, in one way it's really hard for the first world that's 20% of the population using 80% of the world's resources to change.
So what you're saying is, I think your plan is starting to draw into the balance, I guess, between technology and nature. And just like to kind of add this comment. I just think that there's a lot of obviously the balance between the two that needs to happen, because in a sense, what he said with stopping the technology at a point where it's no longer something we need to use, we're just inventing useless gadgets and things like that we don't really need, and then like to the point of balancing nature in where we're actually coming in and we need sustainable communities by building cities sustainably, and cities, the way they're built right now, aren't built sustainably. Like, they're built in ways that you have to have a mode of transportation to get to where you need to get your stuff. And, like, you need three roofs on buildings and, like cities and communities built in circles rather than in large squares where you have to go around it. So I'm just trying to ask, like, I don't know where the balance is coming with technology and what we need to still know about nature and medicine and wildlife.
There was another hand over here. I'm sorry. Who was it that I pointed at? Let's go to you in the back.
I was just wondering what your thoughts were on dumpster diving and freeganism, just in general.
Okay, why don't we just go down this way? If, you know, you can talk on any question you want or pass or whatever. But can we start with Michael this time, since we started down this way?
I've heard it a little bit about those questions, but I mean, in reference to that, in reference to the question about veganism and veganism, like, as an anarchist and as a vegetarian for most of my life, like, I think it's more important where the money's going in a lot of senses. Like, yeah, I don't. When I was vegan, I didn't buy vegan eggs. I didn't buy soy ice cream. I ate other shit. Like, if I wanted ice cream, I wanted like mayonnaise. I eat ice cream and mayonnaise. And then the same thing of, you know, of dumpster diving. Like, I think it's great because you're using these resources, and I think it's a good method for education. In DC, a really short, vignette, we did a really good program. One of the most proudest programs we've ever done, I think, as an anarchist, was dumpstering food and giving out in front of Safeway when they were doing vegan busting, and like using that at every moment to be like, people are like, where's all this food? And, like, we got the dumpster. I'm like, well, why is food in the dumpster? And then you get this conversation about capitalism, waste, and excess. You know, like, it provides provides an opportunity to have these conversations, provides an opportunity to say, like, capitalism is necessitated by these excesses and these wastes, and therefore we are reclaiming that. And it gives you, like, a venue to preach about capitalism. So I think in that sense, it's great. In the same sense, like, yeah, you're going to Whole Foods and, like, yelling at people who think they're self-righteous because they're eating vegan eggs is, like, just as valid.
Yeah, nothing
much to add to that. I agree. I mean, at least in terms of food production, like of course overproduction of all kinds of food. So I think distribution is pretty key. I think shelter diving and all that, any kind of alternative that gets food from point A to point B in a different way, I think is really important.
To answer your question, I think. I mean, I don't know what the balance is, but I think that's why, you know, I thought the DIT concept was really neat, do it together. I think that would be, like, each community with, you know, or set of people with, or some sort of grouping of people would decide, you know, this is the balance that we see between nature and technology, and then you would mediate that within that particular community, but then you would have mediate outside of that community as well with other communities. Like, what if the community next to you wants a nuclear power plant? Like, how do you, you know, that?
Well, what I was kind of alluding at is just that we still need knowledge from, like, traditional, like, from the indigenous, like, way back, like, how they use things in nature. Like, we still need to know some of that. Like, and if we don't understand ecology, then we destroy forest before we even know what that forest can provide for us. You know what I mean? Like, just where's the balance with that? Like, you know, like using plants for wild edibles or medicines,
okay, right.
Or something. You know?
So I think, again, like, my answer would be the same, which is, like, as a community, you would have to decide, okay, at what point is our understanding of nature ecology good enough at this point for us to make certain sorts of decisions? And, you know, yeah, I was like, do you want to add anything?
I don't know if it helps in answering your questions, but I mean, we mentioned in our part of the talk that I think that the question of balance and how relationships between human communities and non-human communities is always going to be contextual, it's always going to be different, it's always going to be dynamic, changing, evolving, and so trying to come up with some sort of specific formula or approach to thinking about what the balance is going to look like, how we're going to arrive at it, like, it's always going to be different in different circumstances. And that's the challenge.
Okay, I'll take a few more. I do want to mention that dumpster diving is not just a sport for anarchist punks, but it's also just a simple survival strategy for homeless people. So, I mean, or for poor people from all walks of life. It's something to keep in mind. You had your hand raised in the collared shirt there, and I missed you last round. So I was going to start with you, and then you, and then you. Okay? Okay, and then we're...
I was hoping you could maybe talk briefly about the statistical method you used. Oh, sorry, Mike. used on your data.
Most statistical methods.
Take three.
Sorry.
I'm just trying to keep it processing. Yeah.
Andrea, I just wanted to. I don't want to get too deep into it, but sort of continuing on the identity versus reflective responses kind of tangent that we've made.
Okay.
The situation involving like people that have like serious food allergies, like gluten-free, egg allergies, and that sort of thing, and the fact that the access to that sort of stuff
really seems to be geared towards the Fuji or Whole Foods kind of establishments, and how shitty that is, because when one is trying to eat ethically, and yet if somebody has too much gluten, it could, you know, seriously hurt them over the long term. So like, that you know, it's a really sticky, shitty situation, and I'm wondering if you have any insight into potential alternative solutions or what one could do based on the research that you've done so far, stuff like that.
Kind of a long-winded question. This is for Andrea. So it's actually kind of funny.
Short,
so I'll shorten it. Okay. It's funny because I actually have been doing work very similar to yours. Like, I quoted the same Dean quotes, kind of creepy, around, you know, the creation of neoliberal governmentalities and food and all that. But I've been specifically looking at it in terms of how social workers in the alternative food movement have been, you know, doing community organizing and kind of putting these ideas onto specifically inner-city racialized people and trying to, you know, bring them into this governmentalized subjectivity. I also have the interesting positionality of also being a full-time farmer. So I get my sustenance from this movement. So I can embody that complexity myself. But so every day, every week, at the end of the week, we go to a packing shed. We pack all our vegetables up to send off to whatever yuppies that we have to sell to do this. And I don't feel like I could ever bring these conversations back to the packing shed with all the other farmers. Because for us, labor is the number one cost. And just by paying myself and my worker a living wage last year, I put my farm out of business. So what would your conversation be with these farmers like me who are struggling and embodying these complexities?
Wow. You want to just start with Carl? Back this way, and then we'll close it off.
Just quickly, I think that it's okay to not feel guilty, like, when the only food available to you is, like, through shitty means of attaining it. Like, don't feel fucking guilty for having to get what you need to eat, and don't let people make you feel like you're a bad person, because that's fucking neoliberal mentality. Like, don't worry about it. But alternatives require, like, intensive labor, and it sucks. Like, food allergies are, like, a really big disability, especially if you're trying to be ethical, because it means you have to fucking spend every Sunday making soup so that you can put it in jars for the whole week, which is what I do, and you eat the same thing for a week, and it's not awesome, but, like, that's what I have so far. But maybe, like, collectively sharing food with people, like a kind of potluck thing where you create, like, Tupperware meals for each other, not bombs, but bigger, with, anyways, that's my example. And in terms of the conversation with farmers, I don't know, like, it sucks that, like, small-scale farming requires, like, free labor pretty much, and I think it has to do with the system and, a food chain that valorizes, like, industrialized, commodified food. So all I can say is that maybe your out-of-work farmers can, like, organize with migrant workers and fucking take over an industrialized farm and... For me, that's the best alternative, is organizing with each other as farmers and taking back industrialized land and producing decommodified food. But it's really idealistic.
I just want to make sure the conversation doesn't pit small, organic, usually white, middle-class farmers who are also marginalized in their own way against the migrant workers, because there is a struggle that's linked, you know? So.
Just to address the statistics question quickly, like I said, I have a high school math education. That wasn't an exaggeration, like, I don't know math. Using SPSS, the Statistical Master Software, statistics, whatever it stands for, there's a thing that says descriptive statistics, and you can basically compare any variable to any other variable. So looking at 22 variables, what I did is the frequency of variable A to the frequency of variable B. So the frequency of window breaking to attacks on fur farms, the frequency of the Netherlands as a target versus the ALF as an actor, the frequency of whatever. Again, looking at 22 different factors and then generating a question and then looking at the comparisons. Most of it is percent, right? You're looking at the percent of factor A into the percent of factor B. And, like, one of the reasons why, like, I'm happy to explain that is because, like, again, like, anyone can do this with any sort of data. It's really, really easy. Really easy.
Cool. Oh, we're ending just on time. I'm sorry. I can't take any more comments because...